This is Las Vegas Weekly's Radio Mag on KUNB, and I'm staff writer Aaron Ryan. On this week's cover, it's Cute Overload, courtesy of Sarah Flake, creator of a whimsical family of toys known as Flaky Friends. Staff writer Kristen Peterson will chat with her about the handmade life and being in our 2011 holiday gift guide. Then I'll catch up with Bobby Dean, bingo manager at Palace Station, about the recent all-paper big money game, Vegas in the 70s, and what kind of luck comes from a green-haired troll.
This is Kristen Peterson with the Las Vegas Weekly, and this week our cover story in time for the holidays, it features local creative types who make things, whether it's jewelry, accessories, toys, or even TVs with mirrors in them, that locals can shop for if they're looking for something unique or they just want to support the local community. And in the studio here with us is Sarah Flake, who makes a line of plushies that I'm sure you've seen if you've been down to First Friday. She's literally mobbed in her booth down there. And so she's got a variety of different toys and plushies. And we're talking to her tonight about her background and how she got started in this. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Great. And we should say you brought some friends here.
Yes. Most of my friends aren't stuffed, but these ones are.
There's a table full of really great characters sitting right here. First of all, now let's talk a little bit about how you got into this, because it's pretty interesting and sort of innovative, the approach you took.
Yeah, well, I was doing some last-minute Christmas shopping in December 2007, and my three-year-old daughter had asked for a very specific type of toy, this purple pony, and for some reason I couldn't find it anywhere. And I was at Borders Books and I saw a book of a guy who just made sock creatures for a living, and I thought, wow, that would be fun. And it kind of gave me the idea to try to make her toy, and so I sewed up this awful looking pink purple. It was a pony in her eyes and she loved it. And I got a kick out of it. And I kind of just kept trying from there. And I had heard about Etsy and I opened a shop just because it's free to open a shop. And I stuck a few things on there, my mangled creations. And I think people looked at them and thought that they were purposefully mangled, and made some sales right away. And the rest is history. I've made thousands since then.
Oh, that's so great. So I didn't realize that the pony didn't actually turn out maybe as it was intended.
Oh, no.
But your daughter loved it.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'm self-taught. I didn't know what I was doing, but I kind of started with a basic beach ball shape and started sticking things off of it and places that were supposed to be legs or arms or eyes. And so the first ones were very rough, and I've since kind of developed my style and created them based off my doodles and been able to really transfer my art to the fabric.
And that's another thing that I thought was interesting is that, you know, people doodle all the time. They scribble little characters. How do you translate that into a three-dimensional huggable object?
My doodles are very puffy. They all have that huge wide-eyed look. I was really into anime and comic books growing up. And so I had that kind of larger-than-life quality already to my doodles. And so when you're talking plush, especially animals, it's really easy to just do a big ball of fluff and, you know, put some big comic eyes on them and put in a little bit of angst. And it's come out to be a pretty strong style for me.
Well, and the other thing is, you're not just sewing these animals or creating them, but as I understand, each one has a story from your days of sort of humor writing. You translated the fiction to these characters. Can you talk about a few of mine? I know you mentioned Svetlana when we're on the phone, and then there's a misunderstood pitbull. Can you just give us a rundown of who they are?
Definitely. No one creates in a vacuum, and that's certainly true for these guys. Like Svetlana, my favorite, is one of them that I base off of my own personality. She's this Russian penguin, and you look at her, she's this little purple penguin with a big pink bow and huge bug eyes and looking very kind of pathetic. And her story is that she's this brilliant Russian PhD, and you know, she wants nothing more to just settle down, though, and she finds that her education intimidates men and she can't ever find a man. And so she got a job at Chili's as a waitress and put on a southern accent, and suddenly she's got men all over, but they're all losers. And so now she's dating losers and she doesn't really know what to do to, you know, get along in life. And that was based off of my experience after freshman year of college, when I came home and got a job at Chili's to earn some extra money. And I found that the more of a Texas accent I put on, the heavier it was, the faker it was, the better tips I got. And it just was really a kind of a shock to me to find that the dumber I acted, the more guys liked me. And so that's Svetlana. She's, you know, in this kind of rock and a hard place situation.
And that's where she is when you meet her. When you grab Svetlana, you take her home, and that is her history up until then.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's great. Now, can you talk a little bit about the pit bull?
Oh, yes. The pit bull is my bugaboo. He is based on the dog in my neighbor's yard that barks all day while I'm at my sewing machine. And for a year, I just sat in my machine and listened to this dog barking and thought, what is wrong with that dog? And finally, I made him into a toy, and I made what I call Misunderstood Pitbull. And I had to create a story to explain why this dog was in the yard barking all day when no one was there. And I decided that Misunderstood Pitbull is kind of a geeky guy, and he likes playing World of Warcraft and practicing his trombone, but he doesn't want his pitbull friends to know that he's not a big, tough guy. So he schedules 3 hours a day, and he has a little alarm that goes off on his Palm Pixie, and he goes outside and barks, barks, barks for 3 hours, and he just wishes that people would accept him for who he is, but he can't really accept himself for who he is either, and so that's why he's all a little disgruntled and twisted. And when you look at his face, you know, his eyes are all akimbo and his mouth is off to one side, and he really does look misunderstood and just searching for identity.
Yeah, he looks at life might be a little more complex than he had imagined, but he's also just really adorable, and he's a favorite one at the office, I gotta say that. And also, he's a good example of your style, like you were talking about with the pony didn't really turn out, and so you put things up, but people thought it was intentional. Mm-hmm. I mean, these aren't your very symmetric, pristine teddy bears we're talking about. And it's definitely not the ugly doll. You've got your own style going on than that brand, but you do have the jagged teeth, the smile that might not be exactly in front. And can you talk about that? Is that sort of an offshoot of the doodles?
I cannot stand measuring or precision or trying to attain symmetry. You know, who can relate to the cheerleader in high school? Who wants to be... I mean, maybe people do want to be the perfect girl, but I never wanted to be perfect. I thought that is ridiculous to try and be something perfect or symmetrical. And so, you know, nothing I make has a pattern. I basically freehand it on, and sometimes they turn out totally lumpy one way or totally lumpy the other. And I think that's what makes them great. That's what makes them one of a kind. And it's just a kind of a spontaneous plush explosion. And you look at it and I want people to feel empathy and to relate and just think, oh, you know, you're a little bit broken. So am I. Let's go on a date, or, you know, I want to take you home.
I'm looking at them right now, and that's a perfect word. I mean, you definitely feel love, and there's some artistic value here just in the color choices and the textures you choose. And you said you buy the material locally?
Mm-hmm. Yep, I pretty much get all my fabric at local fabric stores. When I started my business, I was living in Los Angeles, which has an amazing fabrics district, and so I was really pampered and had kind of my choice of all the fabrics in the world, pretty much. But here, I have to just wait for Halloween, and when Halloween comes, I go into Joann's with my stack of however many coupons, and I buy out the whole fabric section, and I get dirty looks from the cashiers because it feels like highway robbery, but that's the only time of year I can really find a lot of these really awesome plushy fabrics. I just find whatever I can locally, and sometimes I buy a fabric and I don't even know what I'm going to do with it, and it'll sit under the bed for, you know, 6 months, a year, and I'll keep stroking it, and then one day I'll be like, oh, this is what you are, and I'll make it into something. And so I wait for the fabric to speak to me, but I'm basically looking for anything aesthetically delightful.
And you find more of this sort of furry textured fabric on Halloween, or right
around
Halloween?
Yeah, around Halloween is when the stores really stock up on the weird stuff, which is what I like.
Mm-hmm. And then you also have, like, it's not furry, it's more almost like a felt, a durable felt for the gingerbread characters that you created for the holidays, I'm guessing, and then your skeleton characters.
Right. I started doing silk-screened items last year because I wanted to make this certain item. I really wanted to make a skeleton, and I wanted it to be really precise. And I had my drawing, and I couldn't think of how to put my drawing and turn it into a standard plush toy. And so I decided I needed to learn how to silkscreen. So I invested a lot of money into silkscreening supplies and equipment and taught myself how to silkscreen for this one toy, basically. And it has been my most popular. And it's a really it's a different kind of toy. I've sold it to, you know, all ages. But the silkscreen technique is really neat because my doodles are literally now the toy. So I've made some items like the skeleton, the gingerbread man, a few more artsy type dolls like that with the silkscreen technique.
And so the skeleton might be one of the more popular ones?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's definitely popular. I just made it as a Halloween item last year, but it sells consistently every month, and I've probably made about 300 of them.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, how many stuffed animals or plushies and toys do you think you've made since you started doing this?
Oh, I wish I had been keeping track. My estimation is between 2,000 and 3,000, just based off of my total sales, and you figure, you know, a price of $10 average, but I would have to say probably close to 3,000, but again, I haven't been keeping track, but just based off of sales and the amount of sew-in labels I've gone through, that would be a good guess for me. But it's a lot, and I'm living in fear of the day when I get carpal tunnel or my hands get chopped off or an angry shark attacks me at the beach and eats my arms. I know it's going to happen, and that's my tool.
Oh, a career ender. And we should say you are pretty much doing this yourself. Maybe you have two kids, right? Two daughters?
Yep.
And they're maybe helping here and there, but it's
you. They'll
help
stuff a toy. I pay them a penny each to make my little pinback buttons. And, you know, they help pick out eyes. And, you know, they are forever coming in with requests from their schoolmates or friends saying, you know, so-and-so wants a mermaid or April needs a black pony for her birthday present. So, you know, they definitely keep me busy.
Yeah, I was going to say you're probably hit around the neighborhood, just like you said with the birthday parties.
Yep.
And so you make these maybe morning till evening? I mean, this is a full-time job.
This is full-time. If I'm not doing something else, I'm sewing. Usually I try to get in there first thing in the day, and I stay up till midnight. I probably should sleep more. I probably should sew less, but it's really addicting. And the thing about my toys is I never know from month to month what's going to be the hot seller at a certain event. And so if I've spent all my time making pit bulls, a few days before the event, I'll have a crisis of conscience and think, but what if they want angry carrots? And so I'll, you know, stay up till 3 a.m. making angry carrots. Then I get to an event and it turns out all they want were the cats, which I didn't have at all. So it's hard to stay on top of what people are going to be requesting.
And like I said, I've seen you at events and I've seen the crowds just like grabbing and talking and throwing things around. And, oh, you know, one question I wanted to ask you, because for me, it seems like it goes to both, but would you say these are more for adults or kids?
You know, that was a hard thing for me because when I first started selling, it was only online and I was assuming they were kids. And then when I started getting out and doing craft events, I would go to these events with grandmas and little moms and they didn't get it. But when I found First Friday, I realized that was my target market. It was kind of the, you know, 18 to 30, disposable income, a little bit snarky, understood my sense of humor. And so that's who it's resonated most with. But I certainly do make them appropriate for children. I use safety eyes on almost all my products. My silk screenings are water-based. And I've sold them to all ages. It's the funnest thing to go to First Friday and hail down some person who maybe looks like hasn't smiled in a decade and shake a little silly toy at them and they break in a grin and buy five of something. And so that's my favorite thing about First Friday is just making people smile and laugh and making people happy. That's what I do.
Yeah, it's impossible not to smile after looking at these. And just before we finish up here, let's talk a little bit about First Friday. Where you're going to be down there this Friday.
Uh-huh.
And you said north of the Funkhouse on Casino Center?
Right.
And I guess they just look for the booth with brightly colored piles of stuffed animals.
It's hard to miss. Yep. We're on the side they keep us on the west side, about a half block north of the Funkhouse.
Okay. And then also through the month of December, your products will be in the Arts Factory. Is that correct?
That's right.
So people can just go in there. It'll be outside Hell Pop Comics.
That's right.
So check her out. And then she also has an Etsy page. And it's Sarah Flake. Just like it sounds. SARAHFLAKE. And one last question before we close. What does your house look like right now?
Oh, it is an explosion of fur. I'm in crisis mode getting ready for First Friday and my show at Hell Pop. And I have half-formed gingerbread and mangled sharks and unstuffed orangutans and thread everywhere, and there's acrylic paint. It's a disaster, and that's what it always looks like this week of the month.
The good times. For the completed products, go down to First Friday and stop and say hi and look at the little plushies. Thanks again for coming to be on the show tonight. We appreciate it.
Thank you. This was fun.
Welcome back to Las Vegas Weekly's Radio Mag on KUNV. Bobby Dean has been in the business for 40 years, 33 at the property now known as Palace Station, but once called simply Bingo Palace. As keno and bingo manager there, he oversees the daily games and big money events, like the recent $100,000 all-paper extravaganza. I was there, and I didn't see a single head of purple hair. Here to tell us how bingo has evolved is Bobby Dean. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Aaron. How are you doing this evening?
I'm doing great, and I'm still glowing after my very first big money bingo game experience, even though I didn't get a chance to play. Just being in the room was pretty fun.
Yes, we did have a lot of fun. It was a good event. Ran very smoothly.
There were no riots.
the agents working the event, and everybody had a really good time.
Fabulous. Well, we'll talk more about that game later, but what I want to know about first is your long history with gaming here in Las Vegas. I've been told that you started working at the property now known as Palace back in 1978 before it was known as Palace Station. So what I would love is if you could just sort of set the scene for me and for our listeners about what it looked like to be working in gaming then in the late 70s.
When I walked in at Bingo Palace in 1978, it was a very small property. Had some slot machines, a small coffee shop, bar, some table games, and buffet, and a small buffet, and a bingo operation running, and they were in the process of adding a keno game in early 78, along with building a new bingo room.
And how much did the buffet cost in 1978?
Well, I can't remember that one for you. That has kind of come and gone and faded.
Gotcha. But you
it wasn't today's prices, I'm sure.
Oh, I'm sure it wasn't. But you were involved with keno back then.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about keno. I haven't played that one at all, actually.
Well, we started off near the entrance to Bingo Palace back then was the Rancho door entrance, which is a very small door entrance at the east end of the building along Rancho Road up against the freeway. On the freeway side, mm-hmm. and walked in there almost directly ahead to the left was a small coffee shop under a lower ceiling, and that's where we put in the first keno game at Bingo Palace, and there was the bar built next to it called the Keno Bar, and the operation expanded with a new bingo room and a larger number of table games in operation, and then there were subsequent additions that added the section on down towards where the current end of the pit is, about middle of the building, and then another expansion in 83 that opened in 1984 when the property was renamed Palace Station, which included the area where the Pasta Palace is, and that we just kept
expanding. The funny thing is, with gaming, you know, on the casino floor, you obviously will see blackjack, poker, roulette, craps, but you won't see the bingo and keno players. They're in their own sort of private chambers of play. Why is that?
Well, the keno lounges have gotten smaller around the country, and one of the things that isn't obvious about them, keno evolved in the late 80s to allow multi-race keno, and well, in the mid 80s, and then in the late 80s, the computers came into play in the keno games, which made the multi-race keno bets where you could play more than one game at a time first it started off as 5 games at a time.
Mm.
People expanded it to 10 games at a time. With a hand game, it wasn't easy, a non-computerized game, it wasn't easy to track what was going on. It was a lot of work. And once it evolved into the computerized world, now people can play up to 1,000 games.
Oh, man. And lose a lot of money at once.
Yeah. And the thing people miss is the fact that there can be a lot of people actually in play, playing the game, but they're not sitting in the lounge anymore.
Right, right.
They're in the restaurants. They're playing table games. They're playing bingo. Or they're at home watching the Keno game on their computer at home.
Oh, how funny. It's, well, or watching football and playing Keno at the same time.
That's right. They may be watching football on the TV set and watching the Keno game on their computer at the same time.
See, and to me, I'm not a big gambler, but I do like to play sometimes. And to me, the fun and the thrill of it is sort of lost if you're just sitting there clicking a button. I know a lot of people have fun playing that way. They can make a lot of money. But I love the idea of all paper, which is why I was so interested in this big game that was played last weekend at Palace Station, which was a $100,000 all paper bingo game. There were 1,002 players, each of whom bought in for $99 at the chance to win many prizes throughout the day, the lowest being $500 and the biggest being $25,000 for a single game.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, seeing those people in there, I mean, they were serious. There was some, you know, jovial camaraderie and some whispering, but it was very quiet. Everybody was really focused. And as the money amounts got bigger, it got more and more quiet in there. And I was able to watch the $10,000 winner, which was so cool. I couldn't imagine, you know, basically putting down $100 and walking away with $10,000.
I mean, yeah, it's a lot of fun. And the first thing that happens before somebody wins is they become cased or they're waiting for one number to win.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have a lot of people in that situation in the room, up to 75.
Oh, wow.
There's 75 numbers in the game, so
yeah.
There could be 75 people on 75 different numbers, and the next number is called, and it's one person's number, and they're the winner, and they're the one that gets the $10,000 or the $25,000, but all these other folks are sitting around the room waiting to get there.
You can actually hear the tension when they're waiting.
Yeah.
And one of the things I thought was so cool was that even when, you know, those other 74 people or however many lost, there was kind of a like, oh, you know, but then they would clap for the person who won because everybody can appreciate how it would feel to be that lucky. And the luck part is one of the things you and I talked about before, that one of the cool things about bingo is that somebody wins every game, you know?
Right. It's played till there's a winner. The Keno game, you can win $100,000 or more, or for a dollar, we've got a bet that pays almost $1.2 million for a dollar and a half.
Oh,
you can
wow.
win a huge amount of money on a small investment, and that's a lot of the attraction of that game. But when you run a Keno game, it may be that nobody wins.
Right.
Or that every player wins. There's no telling. On the bingo game, it is different. It is played until somebody wins.
Yes. And I talked to a couple of veteran players who said that, you know, they've seen people get so excited about $50. You know, it's more about the winning and the luck and just the excitement that, you know, you were the one, and less about the money, even though you obviously can win a lot of money in these bigger games. And some of the things that people do to set themselves up for winning is bring these sort of lucky totems, personal little charms and weird stuff that people set up on their tables to bring them luck. And I was just walking around the hall, you know, seeing these little troll dolls and Japanese waving cats and photos and, you know, lots of cool stuff. And just wondered some of the weirdest things you've seen in all your years kind of being in there and walking around.
It's and sometimes it's a seat, too.
Oh, really?
In the regular bingo room, they'll have their lucky seat in the bingo room, and they always want to sit in that seat.
Oh,
and
man.
They can get very possessive of their lucky seat.
So it's a certain...
They'll prepare their table space in some special manner.
Yeah.
They may sprinkle salt on it or herbs or something. And besides troll dolls and their lucky daubers or whatever, it's all in fun.
I love it. And you better brush off the seat the next player. Make sure there aren't, you know, some herbs crunched up on there.
Oh, yes. And troll maintenance comes through and cleans the room each session, so you don't have those problems. We got to keep it cleaned up as we go.
Very nice. Now, I was not there for the other big prize on Sunday, which was the $25,000 game, and I was hoping that you could tell me what happened there. Was it exciting?
Yes. As a matter of fact, the lady had kind of been grumbling. She was right up by the call stand, on the end seat next to the call stand, about two rows from the middle of the call stand, and she had said something about, yeah, I'm not lucky today. I haven't been able to win anything all day long. And then here she wins the coverall.
Oh, perfect.
In only 50 numbers, which is remarkable.
Really?
Yeah, 50-number coverall is not too frequent. It doesn't happen all the time. Usually they'll go to 55 to 60 numbers before they get hit. But 50 numbers was a real lucky hit.
It was her day.
She made it. Was pretty certain when somebody hits it at 50 numbers, they're going to be a single winner.
Oh yeah!
And the best I've ever seen is I did see a winner in 45 numbers once. Which is less than that. I don't think I've ever heard of anybody hearing of less than 45 numbers somebody winning a coverall.
But, wow. Well, and you.
It happens.
Hopefully it will happen to me someday.
Yeah.
So I've been told that there is an even bigger money game or tournament of some kind that's coming up at Palace Station next year involving, is it $1 million?
Yes. It's a company-wide event, $1 million bingo. This will be the 4th time we've run the $1 million event.
So is this then at all the station casinos?
Yeah, all 7 station casinos bingo rooms, yes.
Gotcha. Okay.
And it's at that event, because it's multiple rooms so that every room has a bunch of nice winners, it's broken into 2 sessions, a morning session in each property, where each property gives away $32,060 in the morning session at each individual properties during the 2-day event. We give away $500,000 each day.
Oh, boy.
On both Monday and on Tuesday, making it a $1 million event. And then in the afternoons, we link up for the big money games between all 7 properties and give away a total of $276,000 each day.
Now, can I bring my troll doll and play at multiple properties?
You can bring multiple troll dolls. Be my guest.
Yay, thank goodness.
Well, you can only play at one property at a time, but right. We've got 7 of them to pick from.
Yeah, I love
it. Pick where you like to play the most or where your lucky seat is.
I've got to figure out what my lucky seat is. But one thing, the last thing I wanted to ask you was, you know, having been in the room and seen the people playing, I was surprised at the diversity of the crowd, because, you know, bingo does have this reputation of being the game of cute little old church ladies.
Yeah.
And there were a few of them, but there were a lot of young people as well. There were definitely families where you could tell it was like the daughter, the mom, and the grandmother. It seemed like, you know, it was really kind of a cross-section of Las Vegas. And have you noticed that it's trended a little bit more toward young people lately?
I would say in the last 10, 15 years, the crowd has started getting a little bit younger. It attracts people that are just over 21.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of folks in their late 20s, 30s, 40s.
Yeah, I saw a hot number in some stiletto boots and a designer jumpsuit. So
yeah.
Watch out for her. Well, thank you so much for being with us on our show tonight. And best of luck in your own bingo playing.
Okay, thank you very much.
Take care.
Good night.
This has been Las Vegas Weekly's Radio Mag on KUNV. Check out the issue for more with our guests, Bobby Dean and Sarah Flake, as well as Sarah's website, flakeyfriends.com. And a special thanks to our producer, Steven Zeller, who wears slip-on Vans even in the winter.